is the House Judiciary Committee, March 26, 1985, Subcommittee 2.
I'll come to order. We're going to take, because of a variety of different individual scheduling problems, the order that we will proceed this afternoon will be that we will open the hearing on House Bill 2600 and hear from Representative Miller and Representative Bunn. We will close the hearing temporarily on that, move to hearing on 2645, 2667, and then we will go to hearing on House Bill 2205, 2619 for the purposes of hearing Chief Judge Joseph's testimony, and then return to the order of the agenda. So we will begin with House Bill 2600. We have a couple of Judiciary Committee members, Representative Miller and Representative Bunn. Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Stan Bunn. I represent District 29 in the House, and I'm here to speak in favor of House Bill 2600. House Bill 2600 would increase the jurisdictional limit of the Small Claims Court from $1,000 to $1,500. And the simple reason I propose and support this bill is that the experience of people who attempt to have access to the court system is that you cannot, in most cases of $1,500 or less, hire an attorney to represent you through the entire court process and come out of the process spending less dollars on your attorney than your potential judgment. And there's simply a need to give citizens access to the court system in a way that is cost effective. The amount of the jurisdictional limit was raised, I believe, last session to $1,000, but the experience, I think, in the court system is that that simply isn't high enough.
Representative Miller.
Mr. Chairman, members of the Judiciary Committee, my name is State Representative Randy Miller from District 24. I also advocate the passage of House Bill 2600, and by way of information to the committee, I have a bill that was entitled House Bill 2376, which has the identical language to House Bill 2600, which I also am a sponsor of. So for purposes of perhaps blending those together or doing your usual number on 2376, you should note that. As Representative Bunn noted, I think there's a real justification for an increase. Without doubt, the least expensive mode of litigation in a traditional courtroom setting is the small claims department. Attorneys are not involved, and the parties present their cases on their own. Typically, the judge plays a more active role in facilitating the case than in trials in which attorneys participate. The total cost for court fees is much lower because the fees themselves are lower than other district court fees and because several categories of fees are eliminated. Moreover, the absence of the right to appeal precludes appeal expenditures as well. Now, some of these comments I just made were borrowed from a Judicial Commission study that was brought forward in 1982. At that time, there was information that the District Judges Association were in support of an increase of the jurisdictional amount of the Small Claims Court, which was presently, or was at that point, $700, and Representative Bunn is correct that we took action in the last session to increase that limit to $1,000. 68% of the judges who spoke on the question back in 1982 suggested that the limit be increased from the $700, and it's instructive for our purposes today to note that 62% of those judges recommended an increase to as much as the $1,500 that is being requested in this bill. I also think that for informational purposes, and it may not, we don't necessarily know what will happen with the bill we passed to increase the jurisdictional amount of the district courts. But it, I think, certainly gives us a reason to advance the amount in the small claims to at least 1,500 and perhaps even more. From a personal point of view, I would not be offended if this committee wanted to increase the limit beyond $1,500, but I think that's the least we should do.
Are there questions from the committee members? With such great testimony, there is no need at this point for questions. Thank you, John.
Thank you.
If you'd like to join us for the remainder of the afternoon, you're certainly welcome to.
I'll try to monitor you.
Thank you. We'll now close the hearing temporarily. On 2600, I do note that we have some other witnesses on this bill. So we'll move to House Bill 2645, hearing. I believe we have Mr. Burroughs here. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is David Burroughs, President of the Oregon League of Financial Institutions. With us today also is Mr. Bill Lowe, the League's legal counsel. Appreciate very much your taking this bill up, and Mr. Chairman, because we do have, as you indicated, a conflict in another committee. House Bill 2645 does two things very simply. Currently, when a city wants to move on a lien that it holds, there are certain things that the city treasurer must do. In subsection 1, we propose to spell out in a little more detail the specifics of what the notice shall contain that the treasurer must publish and send to the owner. Subsection 2 says that in addition to mailing a certified copy of the first publication to the owner, that the treasurer must also send a copy of the notice to a person having a recorded lien at least 60 days prior to the sale. We have discussed this bill with the attorneys for the City of Portland and with the League of Oregon Cities, and obviously I can't speak for them, Mr. Chairman, but they have indicated to us they have no problem with the two proposals contained in the bill. Questions from the committee, Representative Springer.
Dave, briefly, I recall a bill last session, I think it was Senate Bill 304, that had to deal with notice provisions and publication for trust deeds, and that ran into some question about whether or not there was going to be a reduction in the notice, or this is a different subject, isn't it?
That is correct, sir.
Okay,
this
This
is only a notice that is required when a city is moving on a lien that it holds. We originally, if I may, Mr. Chairman, Representative Springer, we originally had in the original draft of the proposal an additional section which said that the city's lien would not move ahead of a prior recorded position. That did engender some concern on the part of the cities, as you can well imagine. And but prior to introduction of the bill, which this committee very kindly introduced for us, we did remove that proposal. So I hope we have a bill that is not controversial. Further questions, counsel?
Yeah, Mr. Burroughs, in addition to having the city treasurer send notice to people who have recorded liens, can the city treasurer send notices to anybody who requests that?
Yes, that is existing law today.
Okay.
Further questions? Okay, thank you very much. And is there anybody else that wanted to testify on House Bill 2645 that did not sign up? Okay, we'll close the hearing on this bill.
Mr. Chairman.
Oh, Representative Bellamy.
Yes. Excuse me. Is there any reason why in line 17 you used the 60 days?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bellamy, I guess it was a desire to make sure that the
mortgagee, the recorded mortgagee, had sufficient time to move to protect his position, his or her position on the sale, was the reason for the period of time. And again, people we've talked with said they didn't seem to have any problem with that. I can't tell you exactly why we selected 60 days.
Further question? Okay, thank you very much. We'll close the hearing on 2645 and we'll open the hearing on 2667. Mr. Barrows and Mr. Love.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I did give your legal counsel some testimony, which I will not take the time to read in its entirety. Let me just say very briefly, Mr. Chairman, that I have had reported to me some instances in the past where institutions have been served with a subpoena and asked for rather voluminous records. And when the institution suggested that it might be appropriate for the person issuing the subpoena to perhaps pay the institution something commensurate to the time and costs involved, the institution was told in no uncertain terms, you do it for the $5 subpoena fee offered, or you're in we'll see in court for contempt. What we are doing with this bill, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, is very simply suggesting that that in Section 2 and the amendments in Section 4 of the bill, that in Section 2 and in private non-governmental agency cases, and in Section 4 in governmental agency cases, that a standard for what a reasonable fee for reimbursement for the costs incurred by a financial institution be spelled out. These numbers anticipating Representative Bellamy's question, perhaps, these numbers are selected from the federal code, which indicate what is a reasonable charge if a request is made by a federal agency on an institution. These are the amounts that will be paid: the $10 per hour, 15 cents per page, and 20% per mile, and so forth. And what we're asking is that some standard be put into the law that says, not just that the institution can make reasonable charges, but what those charges might be. I'd be happy if the committee wants to read my testimony, but that, in essence, is what we're asking the committee to consider.
Questions from the committee? Counsel?
Yeah, Mr. Barrows again. The first word on Section 2, before producing the documents, the financial institute may require payment. Why do you have it before rather than having the financial institution bill the litigants?
Mr. Chairman, counsel, if you'll look on page 2 of the bill, you will see on line 7, in the case of agencies making requests, that is the current standard. Now, I'm not trying to jump ahead, Mr. Chairman, counsel, but we understand that there is going to be suggestion made that be taken out in this case. We resist that, and Mr. Bronner, I think, will testify as to why we prefer not to have the language taken out in 7. If, in fact, the language remains in line 7 of page 2, the prior to making disclosure, we would suggest the same kind of language was appropriate on line 13 of page 1.
Would it affect the litigation one way or the other, whether to pay ahead of time or behind?
Well, I guess I can't answer your question, Mr. Chairman. Counsel, directly, maybe Mr. Love has a comment on that. But the reason that we're going to resist the suggestion on page 2 is, frankly, we have seen situations. Mr. Bronner can describe these in some detail, where agencies have made requests to financial institutions. The institutions have complied to the subpoena or the request, sent a bill to the agency, and the agency ignores it. And so we're saying if you need the information, it's not unreasonable for us to begin to at least have an arrangement. Now, we can't say exactly how many 15 cents per page, I guess, because we don't know how many pages maybe until we get into it. But we certainly would like to have some kind of an arrangement prior to the time for payment. And that's the reason for the language. Yeah. One thing I should say, Mr. Chairman, and I didn't, it's in my testimony, but I want to point it out to the committee. The bottom of page 1, section 3, the last phrase. If the financial institution is the named party to the litigation, all this doesn't apply. If we're being subpoenaed as a party, not as a third party provider of information, all this is out the window, and as it should be.
Further questions? Could I just ask you quickly about, you're referring to the parallel to what the IRS does currently, or does allow?
IRS has a slightly different fee, Mr. Chairman. Ours is based on the Federal Reserve Board of Governors regulation S, which I would be happy to provide the committee with copies of. We patterned it after Regulation S because it's higher than the IRS.
The IRS is $8.15 an
hour.
That's
correct.
You're going to $10 per
yes, sir,
hour. And then it's the same cost of 15 cents per page. What is copies produced by reader and printer reproduction processes?
I guess if it comes in a repetitive way off a word processor.
Aha. Uh-huh. Okay. And actual copies. Is
right.
20 cents less than, is that what the Fed, do you know what the state pays in terms of mileage reimbursement?
Let's see. The current is for the state is 8 cents a mile, as if I understand it, from 44.430. Mr. Love's memo to me is accurate, and I'm certain it is.
The state pays it. Do SNLs reimburse their employees 20 cents a mile? I'm just curious from the mileage reimbursement, why you put down 20 cents.
Because I think that's what the what Regulation S provides for.
If you could provide that to us.
I'd be happy to. All the women.
Further questions? Representative Springer.
Dave, what's going to happen to the situation with the banks are cooperating with a law enforcement agency in terms of any fraud, anything, using a credit card improperly, you name it? I know there are occasions when not particularly personnel, but customers or people who purport to be customers of the institution who engage in criminal activity, it's necessary to produce a bunch of records for review as part of the police investigation. Are those circumstances going to be covered under this bill?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Springer, these are, in essence, maximum figures. I guess we don't have to slavishly follow this as the reasonable charge. There are many cases, I am sure, when we would not ask for any payment if it was something that obviously inured to our benefit, an criminal investigation. I am certain that we would not, as a matter of automatic policy, be sending along billings with every request.
Okay. I don't know how often that happens, but I assume it does happen on occasion. I don't know if it's a big burden or compares to the kind of problem you described earlier, where people have been making requests that really do put a drain on your resources.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Springer, the institution, the savings and loan that brought this to our attention, is one of the larger institutions. They get, they say, about seven requests a month, or subpoenas for information. How they break out between criminal, governmental agency, and civil, I couldn't tell you, Representative. This is not an effort to, this is not a get-rich-quick scheme, I can assure you, for the financial institutions, Representative Springer, but it is an attempt to give us some ability to recover costs when they are considerably greater than the $5 offered fee with the subpoena. If it's $6 or $7, nobody's going to worry about it. If it's $200, then it's the concern. And obviously, Representative Springer, somebody's going to have to pay for that, and our suggestion is that the people who request the information should be the ones who pay for it.
Representative Peterson?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Dave, could you discuss a little more the travel expenses? Somehow I have in my head that if documents are needed, the call could be made to the correct office and picked up there, and then the lawyer who needs this information should be responsible for picking it up. I'm a little uncomfortable knowing, hearing that there's going to be a lot of traveling.
Well, and I do, if this gives me an opportunity, if I may, Mr. Chairman, Representative Peterson, to say that in perusing the Regulation S language, it does say reimbursement for transportation costs shall be for one necessary cost directly incurred to transport personnel to locate and retrieve the information required or requested, and two necessary costs directly incurred solely by the need to convey the required or requested material to the place of examination. Unless it's someplace else that I can't find immediately, Mr. Chairman, the 20 cents figure must have been a figure that we came up with, which is sort of in line with the IRS, I guess, reimbursement figure. But it is not, I gather, unless I just can't find it in my quick review, it's not in Regulation S. Again, Representative Peterson, it's not in our interest to have people driving all over the place just for the sake of nailing somebody for 20 cents a mile. But if, in fact, we are requested to deliver the material to some place, or it does, in fact, require someone to get in a car to go to a records retention center for an institution, it seems to us reasonable that the requesting party should reimburse some fee. 20 cents may not be a magic number, but something for that. Again, if we're involved in the issue, then there is no fee. But if we're just people that are providing information to other parties, it seems to us some kind of a reasonable reimbursement is not unwarranted.
Representative Peterson.
If I may call you, is that fairly common to have to go traipsing after information?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Peterson, no.
Thank you.
Counsel?
Yeah, Mr. Burroughs, you raise an interesting point. Are we only talking about retrieving documents during the discovery part of the case? Are we talking about the actual trial where a bank, say, official may have to be testify as a custodian of the records, or maybe even after trial?
Mr. Chairman, counsel, both, I think.
Mr. Chairman, pardon.
President Springer.
Well, go ahead and respond on that point because I have a somewhat different question.
Well, I was going to respond on an earlier question you raised with regard to a public agency and a police investigation and so on. Let me say that with regard to a public agency, there's already a whole set of rules or statutory provisions regarding this particular matter, and there are some exemptions in those statutes that we didn't include in all of these amendments. We didn't change anything except to spell out the question of what we thought was reasonable to avoid a hassle that takes place over what's reasonable charges. The rest of the statute is already there. We did not expand on it. We did not contract on it. And then we went over to the only first part of it, which has to do with non-agency, but the civil side, where somebody is going to be a pending domestic relations case or whatever, and they want to see all the checks for the last 5 years. And I can say, as a former head of a financial institution, those things do happen, and some people come in and they want the books. And I mean, they want a lot of documents that take a lot of time, and it doesn't happen every day, but it does happen. And so that's what we were trying to cover under the first phase of it. But no way were we trying to either expand or contract from what the existing law is regarding what agencies are exempt. And I believe if you look under ORS 192, there's some provisions there for police investigations to which you referred. The other question I just might shed some light only as an example is that in our particular law firm, for example, Representative Peterson, currently if some of our people that use their automobile transportation, we pay them 25 cents a mile. And whether that's standard or something, I don't know, but 20 to 25 cents a mile is about, I think, in the area of par for the course in the private sector for mileage reimbursement where people use their own automobiles.
Representative Springer.
Yeah, I just real quickly, I may have missed this earlier. Would this apply to a customer who says, hey, I've lost a check last month and I thought for sure it had come through, but can you show me your records to show whether or not it cleared? You know, those things which come up.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Springer, no.
Okay.
It would cost more to worry about that than, you know, I mean, there are some, and there are many times when probably an institution could charge a bit more under this proposal, but wouldn't. But it's the case where somebody comes in and says, I would like to see every daily transaction slip on Mary Smith for the last 7 years. They're in they're in a divorce proceeding or something like that, and it has happened, and it takes a lot of time and a lot of money, and $5 doesn't really come close to covering.
Representative Spanner.
This is from left field, but maybe you can help me out. Is there a statute or a rule which now permits banks or other financial institutions to charge for cash and checks not drawn on that bank, or is that just a matter of bank custom and practice?
I think I'd like to yield to Mr. Bronner.
We're new in the check cashing business, okay. Representative Spanner.
I don't know the answer either way.
Okay, maybe we'll see.
I think the law is sound, but I could be wrong. That's just a guess.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Bronner will be up, and I'm sure he'd be delighted to answer your question.
Further questions?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You're excused. Mr. Brooks, Oregon Corporation Division, please. Mr. Bronner, did you want to join us up here?
Mr. Chairman, members of the Judiciary Committee, my name is William Brooks. I'm a senior securities examiner with the Corporation Division and work in the enforcement area of the security sector. During the course of our investigations into fraudulent sale of securities, it's often necessary for us to obtain bank records from the person who sold the security. This is necessary either to locate or to follow the paper trail telling us what's happened to the investor's money. Cooperation of the financial institutions has been excellent. Billings for costs incurred by banks have been both in excess of and below the proposed price list set out in the amendment. And in the interest of uniformity and predictability, we would support the change from reasonable charges that they are now entitled to those enumerated in House Bill 2667. While this bill is before the committee, there is, however, another point that we would ask it to consider. Section 4 of 192.580, subsection 2, found on line 7 of page 2 of this amendment, maintains the language that is in the existing statute to the effect that prior to making disclosures, a financial institution may require that the requesting state or local agency reimburse the financial institution for reasonable costs. Banks have always insisted on prepayment. Quite often in investigations, speed is important. Money or parties may soon be gone. This prepayment provision often then requires our staff to walk through a request for a check. This utilizes manpower that can be better used for other investigative purposes. The alternative is to delay the investigation for about 7 days for a normal processing of a check for payment. We believe that this is an acceptable period for banks to receive payment in. We would therefore ask that the words prior to making disclosures on line 7 of page 2 and also on line 13 of page 1, as Mr. Barrow has pointed out, be deleted, and rather a subsection be added at the end of the amendment, a subsection D, stating that these costs shall be billed to the state or local agency and paid in the ordinary course of business. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Thank you very much. Questions from the committee? Mr. Brooks, if I could ask, perhaps you could refresh my memory on this. When the state owes, and maybe it's just in the construction public contracting law, but I thought that when the state owes somebody money, that interest is paid on this amount owed, and it's some, and the, I think the lobbyists from the Associated General Contractors during the high interest period put in about, you know, 18% per annum or 24-25% per annum. Does that apply to these billings?
No, these billings are strictly under Chapter 192, which provides for subpoena or consent access by state or local agencies And the existing statute says that they are entitled to reasonable charges. And the reason there's no interest provided for is that they get the charges up front before we get the information.
Well, suppose we were to do this now, and I assume that I think the financial institutions, they don't like your amendment. And what if we were to suggest something that, since we are putting dollar amounts in the statute, that we attach some sort of interest penalty if it's, the billing isn't paid within 30 or 45 days?
We would, Mr. Chairman, we would support such an amendment.
Mr. Bronner, what do you think of that idea?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Frank Bronner with the Oregon Bankers Association. One of the reasons that we resist removal of the prepayment, and in former days, we never insisted on prepayment, but there needs to be a discipline. This has become such a big problem for us, we've even printed a brochure for local governments on how they can cut their costs of discovery. What needs to happen when there is a discovery process, we need to know what they're looking for and we can cut their costs. There needs to be a conversation in advance. If we know what they're looking for, we can give them an estimate and we're perfectly satisfied in doing the work and then being paid if they pay. We have a situation in Southern Oregon that occurred just 2 weeks ago.
Around the room on my knees, I'll do anything at all, but don't do this. For one reason, I could say as a personal matter, I wouldn't work on a court that had to write an opinion in every case. I do work on a court now that writes more opinions per judge than any court in the land, that has the shortest turnaround time of any court in the land, and has a remarkably successful record of preserving its cases when they're reviewed by the Supreme Court of Oregon. I ask you not to do this. Thank you.
Questions from the committee, Representative Bunn.
Judge Joseph, I agreed with your testimony concerning the problems of fiscal impact, location, the problems that the bill would create. I don't happen to believe that all of the cases you don't give a written opinion on are crap.
No, I didn't say all of them.
No, I realize that. And I also don't believe that a number of people who feel there should be more written opinions don't understand or aren't interested in how the process works. I personally believe if we had the dollar resources, we should have more written opinions. I have had cases before the Court of Appeals that I hope weren't crap that it would have been very helpful as a private attorney to understand why the decision was made, both in terms of representing clients, in terms of appeal, in terms of future work before the courts. Do you see any way that we can, without mandating this extent of action by the court, do something to get more written opinions, or do you feel that we need any more written opinions?
We write too many opinions now, Representative. We write far too many opinions right now. There's just no question about it. An opinion ought to do at least two things if it's written. It ought to explain to the lawyer who feels that he needs it to explain to his client. Now, I agree with that, and it ought to be of use to other people. Now, if we could produce more written opinions that were just for the purpose of helping the attorney explain to that client, then we might say there's a need for more written opinions for that purpose. But what that creates is what I call underground authority. In California, they have the practice of non-published opinions. They're supposedly not citable. There's even a commercial service that prepares them, prints them, and distributes them to the bar. They become hidden authority. That is, they're not published, they're not citable, but some attorneys know about them. Some attorneys use them. I frankly, Representative, would hate to see that become the system in Oregon. We get an opportunity to see the same question so many times that it We've got more law, for instance, on domestic relations. We've got more cases on domestic relations in this state than Nevada does, than the state of New York does. We've got more decisions in workers' compensation cases than any state in the country. We may also have the worst workers' compensation system in the country, be that as it may. We've got more decisions in that area. And they are not helping the situation at all. And we've got, you know, when I came on the Court of Appeals, I think we were at volume 17 in 1977. We're now at volume 69 of cases. And that's only been in 7 years, representing. No, we don't need more opinions. Yes, more opinions can be done, but there's no need for them.
Representative Bunn.
Well, I share the concern that opinions, written opinions, should be a quality opinion that we can all be proud of and stand for something. But in between that quality, extensive, clarifying opinion and no opinion at all, isn't there some summary type of response that would trigger information to the litigants involved?
Representative, I think that would be the unfairest thing we could do. If one understands that a decision without an opinion has been subjected, if I may say this, it's been briefed ordinarily, sometimes not both sides. It's been argued if the parties choose to argue it. Well, I'll start with, it's been briefed, and those briefs have been read by three judges. Those three judges have met and discussed the case before oral argument. They have given the parties an opportunity to be heard in oral argument. And the three judges have discussed it afterwards, and they have decided to decide it without an opinion only if all three judges are in agreement. Now, is it fair to attempt to produce some summary without producing the whole process of why we get it, in essence, to the not worth an opinion view? I don't think it is. I think it is potentially misleading to do it in summary fashion. I think if an opinion is written, it has to deal with everything in it that is a fair question. I do not think summaries do it. I know checklists don't do it, unless we've got a very large box that just says nothing in this case is worth writing an opinion about, which we would use in a great many, although I don't see what that achieves. And we have before us a decision that came to us from somewhere. It came to us either from a court or an agency. Those are the two kinds of cases we get. When we affirm without opinion, despite some people's inability apparently to understand this, as I've read, it means that in our opinion the trial court correctly decided the case on the law, if it's a pure law question, and on the facts, if it's a fact question, and the facts and law, if it's a fact and law question. Now, that's what affirmed means. We never reverse without opinion. We only affirm without opinion. And that's the only way we can do the business, and I frankly think it's the only way we should do the business.
Thank you.
I've said something laughable, apparently, but
that's okay. Further questions? And Judge, I do appreciate that your time is limited today. So.
Oh, I'm so interested in this subject, I could stay all day.
Counsel.
Okay. Judge Joseph, if a person, an appellant, appeals and raises two issues, and upon review of the panel, let me give you an example. There is an allegation that the trial court judge's decision, there was a lack of substantial evidence and there was abuse of discretion of the trial court judge to make that decision. If you found substantial evidence on the record, would you also decide, or would you also not decide on the abuse of discretion question?
Well, the process, if I understand your question, counsel, would go somewhat like this. There are two issues presented, and they've been briefed and they've been argued. We might say, well, look, if there was substantial evidence to support the judge's conclusion, the other point is moot. It doesn't need to be decided, in which case we might go off on that. simply on that. And even though the discretion question is interesting, it's not decisive in the case. We wouldn't write about it, but we wouldn't write about that, if I may say, even if we produced a written opinion on point one. One of the things about the Court of Appeals that I think is the only, well, I think that it is one of its virtues that I wish a lot of other courts in the United States would learn, is that we don't write about anything that is not decisive to the case. So that you'll notice we have footnotes frequently. It is not necessary to decide the other issues in this case. And that's a very common thing, and necessarily so. There are other courts around that write on every issue. Just some are required to.
Further questions? I have a wonder, I guess, in my mind, and that is, you know, if a panel, three, four judges spend a lot of, you know, spend time on a case and they talk about it and they finally agree that it ought to be AWOPed, to coin a phrase, why shouldn't we get the value of that discussion even in a limited form? I mean, how much longer does it take in some summary fashion to, after that discussion has gone on, and in light of the fact that a lot of this writing and work does go to your clerks,
You just said the magic words. The answer to your question is lots of time. The process of deciding a case with a written opinion is not simply a process of writing it down. It is not just one judge writing it down. It's one judge writing it down and then defending that before his other two people on the panel and me and a staff attorney. That's the initial process. Once that's gotten by, and we spend a lot of time on making sure we've done the best we can to say things accurately, as narrowly as possible with respect to the issue,
but
and
even
as clear as possible. Now, if I may continue,
sure,
for just a moment, if you start talking about summaries, then there must go out of it that process of caution and careful writing and trying to say no more than needs to be said. Summaries are, if you want summaries, you know, you look at the headnotes in the advance sheet, and a lot of lawyers never go beyond that. But summaries are by their very nature potentially misleading, and they're still going to be law. A written opinion, whether it's a summary or not, is law.
But wouldn't they be recognized as summaries as such and taken for that value?
No.
Because the bill, as I read it, still allows you to distinguish between a full opinion and...
God knows what that distinction is, Mr. Chairman. I realize that the drafter of the bill thought it was a very simple amendment. I don't know the difference between a memorandum in writing with reasons and a full written opinion, except the word memorandum. But I can assure you that the adversary system does not admit of people not taking things seriously. And we would then, of course, spend a lot of time defending the situation of the summary in Smith versus Jones reads a little differently than the summary in Jones versus Smith, and distinguishing that. The system doesn't need it. What the system needs is the quick, effective dispatch of business with the people who are employed, if you will, or elected to do the judging, being able to judge that which is worthy of a writing as well as that which is not worthy of a writing. And that, we spend a lot of time on that. I hope it's understood that what we do, in fact, we don't say, oh, that's an AWOP. That isn't the process at all. The question is, one person will say, I don't see any reason for writing an opinion on that, this one. And I can assure you that in many instances, the way a written opinion finally does get written is because somebody says, wait a minute.
Well, let me ask you this. And I think this comes up in some of the testimony we're going to hear. What do you, if you're the attorney, you lose at the Court of Appeals or even in an agency situation, and you folks affirm without an opinion, and then you appeal to the Supreme Court, and and you're either denied cert or they affirm without an opinion. What do you tell the client when the client says, why did we lose? Where did we go wrong? Where did you go wrong?
In the first place, I would do what I did when I was a practicing attorney if there was a case going to the Court of Appeal. I would tell my client in advance that there's a chance that we will not even get a written opinion out of this case. That's lesson number one, and not enough attorneys can bring themselves to do that because then it's a little bit difficult to take the next step. But assuming that has been done, then I handled more appeals than most lawyers handle. I never had any difficulty telling my client what the problem was, that the court did not believe the issue presented was of sufficient merit to require a written opinion. We lost, and then I could say those dirty sons of bitches. But that is not any reason why the system should be changed, because they're still going to be dirty sons of bitches. They're just going to do it in writing, and it's going to be a waste of time. You see, everybody puts it in terms of a client problem. The problem is, in major respect, is the client isn't told ahead of time that this might happen. And frankly, lawyers are a little bit hard-pressed to explain why they recommended an appeal. They're hard-pressed to explain it to us many times.
Well, see, my problem, Judge, is that it's my old friend over in Kaiser in West Salem that, they're taxpayers. And they don't go to the Court of Appeals and Supreme Court a lot of time.
Right.
And they pay their taxes for 20 years, and finally they have to use the judicial system for something, for maybe one case in their lifetime. And then, they've got this attorney that they paid, $150 an hour for, and or some such amount. And I was trying to help you out there a little bit. And then they get no reason. And
well,
so the lawyer tries to blame you folks,
and
more than likely, that the guy is wishing that he or she didn't spend the $150 an hour, period.
Well, I guess I have a problem seeing the psychological difference between that and going to a jury and having the jury come back and find against you, and you say, why? You go to your lawyer and you say, why'd we lose? And the lawyer says, GD jury
well,
did it to us.
Let me suggest one reason is that I think we pay jurors $8 a day, and we pay judges, $50,000-$60,000 a year.
Well, 50.
But, see, now you got to be optimistic, Judge.
Well, 50. Well, I don't get the point.
See the problem with the taxpayer? They're not using the system a lot. They only use it once or twice in their lifetime.
That's correct.
And then when they get one of these cases to go up to the appellate court, they don't get any reason from you guys that make $50,000 a year. That's the problem.
It is a problem.
Thank you. Representative Bond.
Judge, I'd like to have your thought. It seems to me if we could do so without expending unnecessary resources, it's helpful to have a circuit judge, wherever possible, give a clear indication of why he or she made a decision. Have the Court of Appeals do the same and the Supreme Court the same, so that we have, as we're developing a process through the courts, clear indications of what the signals are. There's a frustration before the circuit courts that at times you get a decision and you think, where's it come from? Wouldn't it be better for our system if we can do it without wasting resources to try at each level to get the best possible information from the judges as to why their decisions are coming about?
Well, abstractly, yes. In fact, no. At least at the appellate level. In fact, there is not much to be gained. One of the wonderful things about sitting on the Court of Appeals is watch new judges coming to the Court of Appeals full of pep and vinegar and maybe some other thing, and see what happens after a fairly short while. And it isn't cynicism, Representative Bunn. It is not cynicism. We are not a cynical group over there. But what they do is they come in and they say, how have you guys stood this all this time? How have you borne up under this burden? Look at the stuff that comes in here. Now, agree that most of the stuff is in the criminal law area. That's where the system, for reasons that I mentioned very early on in this session, has got to be looked at, because it begs for meritless appeals. But on the other hand, there are a lot of people who are abusers of the system, who believe that an appeal is part of the American way of doing justice. Now that, you and I, well, I am old enough to know that that's a relatively new phenomenon. And lawyers encourage it for whatever the reason. I'm proud to say that when I was a practicing lawyer, which is getting to be a long time ago, I did not encourage appeals. I discouraged appeals. But from what I see now, there's a great tendency out there to encourage appeals. I think that's bad. And I may say the written opinion requirement would encourage more appeals. I believe it would actively, it would lead to more appeals than it does now, and I don't think that's necessary.
Thank you.
I appreciate the committee's time. I've taken too much of it.
Let me see if there's any more questions. Thank you very much for joining us today. It's always
a
pleasure. Mr. Collins, okay, and Representative Peterson. I should let folks out there know that we committee has one other witness signed up for 2619, Mr. Reel, and then we will take a short break after finishing the hearing on this bill.
I wonder if it would be in order before.
Could
Mr. Chair. I'm Nancy Peterson, representative from District 52. Mr. Collins, Hugh Collins, is a lawyer, actually not in my district, but in the Medford area. And I was pleased to learn just recently that he practiced law with Jim Redden for a number of years. So he brings good credentials in my mind. I would like to turn over the hearing to Mr. Collins, because he's certainly more knowledgeable about this area than I. So.
Thank you, Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Collins, for driving up here today. You have our envy and having practiced.
I wouldn't
with a good
have missed
judge.
It.
Pardon?
I wouldn't have missed it.
Oh, okay. Great.
I gather from remarks of Judge Joseph, who is a tough act to follow, and this is the first time in all the years I've known him, and they exceed 20. That I've ever been in disagreement with him. But I gather that I should have buttressed my side of this measure by having the Attorney General come in to speak his piece. But I don't believe that the situation is quite as dire as Judge Joseph paints it. What this measure would do, what it would cost, how it would work, I have set down in a written statement, which I submitted to the committee. And rather than go through that statement, read it all over again, I would first ask permission to read into the record the statement of Frank H. Loggison, chairman of the Oregon State Bar Committee on Practice and Procedure. Mr. Loggison says this: in recent years, the Oregon Court of Appeals, no doubt in part at least because of its workload, has frequently resorted to disposing of cases by affirming them without opinion. For example, see Exhibit A here too, and he sets forth three pages of photocopy, which sets forth these cases cited 72 Oregon Appeals 184 and 185 on February 23rd, 1985, and 72 Oregon Appeals 222, March 9, 1985, affirmed without opinion. While this practice may have a salutary impact on the docket of the Court of Appeals, it has had a detrimental effect on the relationship between lawyers and their clients.
In this regard, it should be noted that in those cases which are affirmed without opinion, there is no finding that the appeal was taken in bad faith. Consequently, it is obvious not only that the appellant feels rather strongly that reversible error occurred, but also that the appeal was not frivolous. I am not contending that the Court of Appeals should be required to write a full-scale opinion in every case coming before it. However, some explanatory opinion regarding the disposition should be issued. For example, Exhibit B here too is a per curiam opinion. He attaches a very short one that says the job. Brief opinions along this line would not be too onerous on the Court of Appeals, as presumably some consideration is given to the merits of the case before deciding to affirm without opinion. A brief recitation of the reasons for that decision would go a long way to alleviate the strain between lawyers and their clients, and would, of course, place the Court of Appeals in a better light before the litigants themselves. The Oregon State Bar Committee on Practice and Procedure endorses House Bill 2619, with the qualification, however, that the bill should state that written opinions must be rendered rather than may be rendered. Mr. Loggison is referring to line 5 of the measure. The Supreme Court or Court of Appeals may decide cases before it. He suggests that that may be deleted and the word must be substituted. I quite agree with Mr. Loggison. That is my oversight. I will explain why I quite agree with Mr. Loggison. In my opinion, though I'm not a judge, and as my father told me, you have to remember the law is what the Supreme Court says it is. We didn't have a Court of Appeals in those days. It has always seemed to me that this is a fair rule of construction for statutes or for contracts or for anything else. When you include one thing, you exclude others. If I may, I'll give you an example. Assume that we're living in a very small town that makes this practical, and I'm your grocer, and I make deliveries just as the doctor still makes house calls. You tell me, all right, deliver my groceries. You may deliver them to the back door or the side door. Does that mean that I can also say, aha, I can deliver them at the front door too? No, it does not. Under the statute ORS 19.180, as it presently reads without the amendment, the legislature has given the appellate courts two choices. They say they may decide cases by means of memorandum decisions and shall prepare full opinions only in such cases as it deems proper. The Court of Appeals has not been given permission by the legislature to affirm these things without opinion, without giving reasons. Is it all right if I mix my statement on two bills here? This point hits at House Bill 2205, Section 12 also.
Yes, why don't you go ahead?
Turning to page 5 of House Bill 2205, Section 12, lines 35 and line 36, where decision is defined, I am opposed to these words: an order affirming without opinion, and to those words immediately below it, an order denying or dismissing an appeal. I'm opposed to it for this reason. First of all, this in effect amends ORS 19.180 without ever mentioning it, and thereby would legitimate a practice that has been so questionable that we can't seem to enter that area without arousing emotion and controversy. Likewise, that portion of House Bill 2205 that I'm addressing runs directly contra to the proposed thrust of House Bill 2619, which is the principal subject of my reason for being here. So one or the other must yield, or you're going to have two conflicting statutes. Now, I will not attempt to cover all points possible, but one of the committee brought up a point that I think is a very valid one. In essence, the question was asked Judge Joseph, why, if you've gone through the decision-making process and made up your mind, you must have reached a reasoned decision, and therefore, your work is behind you. With that, I agree. Now, it may take me a long time to make up my mind about something. Once I have made up my mind, it doesn't take me very long to set down the reasons for my decision. It may be that I would not like to have those reasons made public. Nonetheless, if I set down the reasons for my decision, it's zip, zip, zip. Another thing that Judge Joseph said, and to which I take exception, he referred to a number of cases that came before them as crap. This is quite possibly so. We have a number of inmates at Oregon State Law School on State Street who are filing all kinds of habeas corpus, and you name it. And it is true that probably the bulk of that stuff is orger. And I can see his point. But at the same time, I do not go along with the suggestion that legitimate appellants should be buried in the fallout from all this garbage of which he's speaking. Nor do I agree with him when he said that all three judges have made up their mind and it's so clear